Welcome back to BSA by Design, a podcast about transforming healthcare educational and research facilities through expert design and insight. I'm your host, Brian Moore. This is the third part in a mini-series looking at BSA as we celebrate the firm's 50th anniversary. At BSA, our mission is to deliver inspired solutions that improve lives. Our tagline, "Design that inspires what's next," isn't just a statement, it's a call to action. Through our design philosophy and vision traction organizer, we align our practice around three core design drivers: human-centered design, intelligent structures, and technology-infused design. Together, these shape how we explore the future, connect with people, and create meaningful spaces for healing, learning, and discovery. And that's exactly the focal point of this episode. Our guests are Tim Bashi and Justin Beadle. Tim Bashi is the Chief Design Officer at BSA. Tim received his bachelor's degree in architecture from Miami University of Ohio and his master's from Washington University in St. Louis. Prior to joining BSA in 2010, Tim was the architect at ACI Boland. Tim is also the member of the BSA Executive Leadership Team. He was previously guest on Episode 10, where we discussed BSA's innovation framework. Justin Beadle is a design principal with BSA, a member of the BSA Board of Directors, and also serves as the St. Louis Studio Director. Prior to joining BSA, Justin worked for Blitz, where he held several roles as Principal, Design Director, and Project Architect. He also worked for Fow Long Architecture. Justin received his Master of Architecture and Master of Construction Management from Washington University in St. Louis. He is a registered architect and a member of NCARP. He's also previously been a guest on this podcast. Welcome back to the show, guys.
Thanks for having us again.
Yeah, great to see you. As you probably know, we've been doing a 50th series on, or a series on BSA's 50th anniversary. And the first few episodes so far, we've been taking a look at the past, you know, origins and foundation of the company and some culture and core value stuff. I wanted to start to shift into looking at the future. And that's why I thought you two would be great, because we got this tagline. It's not necessarily a mission statement, but it's something that we've had out there for a little bit. Design that inspires what's next. So, Tim, I'll start with you. What do you think of when you hear design that inspires what's next?
Design that inspires what's next is really, it's an aspirational challenge for our design teams. You know, our mission statement, creating inspired solutions that improves lives, is kind of the why. It's the why our teams get out of bed in the morning and come to work. It's why they work at BSA. But when you talk about this aspirational challenge, it's really kind of, it points us forward. You know, you talked about our 50th anniversary, and we did a really good job, I thought, earlier this year at our corporate retreat, Engage, you know, celebrating the success of 50 years. But Tim Spence did a really good job of using that as a launching pad, the moment for us to kind of look forward. And he casted that forward 50 vision. And in it, in his speech, he kind of delivered three focal points, you know, design drivers for us to focus on. And that was intelligent systems, human-centered thinking, and emerging technologies. And we've taken those three drivers, if you will, and we've baked that into BSA's design philosophies. And, you know, when I think of inspires what next means, it's that we don't rely just on past success. We push on those boundaries and we stay curious. And we're going to be staying curious about those three drivers that Tim outlined. And it makes it exciting for our teams. And we want to be a part of shaping what's coming in healing, learning, and discovery.
Let's dive in a little bit into those three things. One of them being human-centered thinking. I've heard you also talk about human-centered design. For the both of you, what does human-centered design mean specifically at BSA?
Yeah, it's about designing for people and not just programs. It's really a core driver for us on every project and really thinking about how we connect with the people that will be experiencing that place, students, nurses, and researchers, and how we can affect the work they do day to day by the design we do. It's about taking our design beyond a container for things. I think that's kind of a common idea in American architecture, especially about from those outside of architecture, you know, that give me a roof and I can do whatever I want underneath it. I actually had my grandfather once said, like, I don't understand why every church just can't look the same. And there's certainly a way that's true or could be true, but we have so many individuals that we work with, so many individual approaches to medicine or education or research, and so many specifics within those that we really would be doing a disservice if we just said, yeah, let's make a shed and like you stuff your stuff in there and you do whatever, right? The place where we really make a difference for our clients is where we center on them and do something more than just provide them, you know, X square feet.
Yeah. For me, it really starts with the alignment sessions in our design process. You know, all of our projects start with a custom tailored alignment session. You know, it's a chance for us to really pause, look at not just what they need, but understand why they need it. And it gives us a chance to meet with the end users, the key stakeholders, the community, and have meaningful conversations about the problem we're trying to solve. And if you do that, and you do that the right way, you can start to create an impact statement that we can rally behind, both as a design team and as a community. But you can also use that as a way to start to prioritize what's important, because everything you might need or everything might be important, but it can't all be important. We know that. So when we start to prioritize our thinking and our needs and our vision, it really serves as lenses that we can, during the design phase of the project, we can start to take our ideas, filter them through those lenses, and also start to prioritize when maybe sometimes we have to start to evaluate, hey, we have a lot of great ideas, but we can't afford them all. Well, we can start to protect the right things. And I tell you, almost every project, when we start to walk through a completed project with a client, I can't tell you how many times they'll point to something and say, I'm so glad we kept this in the project. And that's when you know you've done the right things. And then the reason we did that, it all can tie back to something as simple as a meaningful conversation and alignment session that ties directly back to that success.
So, Tim, let's talk about why maybe human-centered design is becoming even more critical today. What's changed in the environment?
Well, people are experiencing a great amount of change in their lives right now with technology. Mm-hmm. We have to be able to give them a space that they feel is intuitive, personal, and flexible. People are growing to expect that right now. You know, people are tech savvy, but they don't know when it doesn't take much for them to be frustrated when it doesn't work, right?
Good point.
I've got a phone and it does a lot of great things, but when it stops working, you know, it's frustrating. People should feel that way about their space too. They want to be able to personalize their space, especially in the healing environments. If we have patients that are going to be in an infusion center, for example, for 8 hours, they should feel like they have some control over that space, whether it's noise, comfort. Yeah. If they want to get a little bit warmer, we want to provide that service to them, and it shouldn't be one size fits all for everybody. We have the ability to do that. And that's something that when we talk about that human-centered design, that's that extra care that I think we as designers need to provide. So it's a changing world and we need to change with it. It's not just, as Justin was saying, why can't all the churches be the same? Every project's different and every space that we approach has to be thought of as unique for right. our clients.
Interesting. Justin, on the evolution of the design process, can you talk about some of that evolution a little bit?
Yeah, we use what we call our innovation framework, which has 4 steps, explore, align, design, and evaluate. And I think the creative in all of us hears that and they're like, why such a structured way to define your process? Isn't it all just kind of like free form and flowy? And you hear in that visioning session that Tim was talking about with the client at the beginning, you know, something, and you respond very naturally and fluidly. And so there is a way that some of the most powerful architecture responses come that way, but we're working in very large teams for large clients, and we need a way to have this shared understanding of what we're doing and why. So
right.
to help designers come alongside us, architects, engineers, interior designers, all kind of row the boat in the same direction is one way that is important in this process. And then our clients too, right? We don't just have some dude we're meeting with. We have very diverse teams. That we need to, or very diverse clients that we need to help understand why decisions are being made, some that they have influence in, some they don't, and continually align them and bring them along and then evaluate it with them to make sure that we have a really mutually accountable solution for them in the end. Mm-hmm. I think about it kind of as a counterpoint to something in my personal life where I tinker with woodworking, and yeah. I very rarely will draw something out and then build it, right? Like it's okay for Justin to go to the workshop and do a little of this and a little of that. The buildings we design are about as far from that as they could be. And so we need a very different process that in some has intuition in some places, but has enough structure so that everyone can understand and kind of come along and join, like I was saying.
Yeah.
I agree with what Justin's saying on the design process. The evolution that I'm seeing is there's a desire to go faster. The tools want us to go faster. The schedules are getting tighter, it seems. And I think that's great. But at the same time, we want to make sure our teams are having the space they need to be curious about things.
Yeah.
And making sure they're looking at more than one idea. They're kind of getting that time to be, you know, that space they need to be for reflection and strategy. And I think that's when I look at the innovation framework and I look at those first two steps, explore and align, that's that hard pause that we give them in the design process for them, for that space. And making space for reflection and strategy, that's where great design starts in my mind. We know the tools will get us there fast, but
right.
we want to go fast with the right ideas and the right vision and the right solution, not just with our first idea.
I like this idea that you guys are talking about of, maybe it's the writer background in me, but you've got to give curiosity some space, some breathing room, right? Like if I was told to sit down and write something in 30 minutes, I'd spend 25 thinking about what it was and maybe 5 minutes writing on it, right? So we've got to give that time to explore with, like you said, Justin, maybe some guardrails or some boundaries and very, very interesting stuff. Let's move to the second one a little bit. Let's unpack the idea of intelligent structures. So how are buildings becoming more adaptive or responsive?
In so many ways, right? I think I got into architecture because I wanted to decide what buildings look like. And here I am 25 years later or something, and I still like doing it, but only a little bit of what I do is about what buildings look like. It's really about how they respond to their occupants. There's a connection there with the human-centered aspect of these things. What the example Tim gave in Fusion Center, right? We want people to have control of their environments. But we also want to use technology to help these buildings adapt through the day based on what we could expect in a given situation. So that involves mechanical, electrical, plumbing systems, lighting, and acoustics that can all be tuned to environments and human needs through usage patterns and occupancy patterns that we expect through the day.
Yeah, and it can also be as simple as designing for adaptability and flexibility. We have spaces that flex as research evolves, clinic that shift to team-based models. Intelligence isn't just in the systems, it's in the planning. Our job is to design structures that stay relevant over time. And I think that's important.
Yeah, that's a way that my grandpa was kind of right. Like you want the building, you want all the churches to be the same, but you don't want it to feel like that when you walk in the door. And that's really true for a lot of our clients there who are thinking about flexibility long-term and adaptability even in short-term. What can change in a day? What can change in a week or a month? Or what's going to change in 20 years? And we're really collaborating with them closely when it comes to their business model in a lot of these cases. And we want them to be able to evolve that every 5 years and quickly respond in their building environment to support it.
So let's shift a little bit and into the topic of the last probably 18, 24 months or more, but AI, of course, and how, Tim, is AI helping you ask better questions during design, not just a tool to play with, but what is it doing for you?
Yeah, as designers, we tend to think in layers, and that's a great thing, but we also are the I don't know how to say this, but like the project clock is always running. And so I think every time you think, when you look or talk to a designer, they're always going to tell you they wish they had more time to think about this detail or to look at this problem or this area of the project. With AI, yeah, certainly AI, there's a lot of automation and speed, but there's also a lot of depth and thinking and answering questions. And in my mind, that's the excitement part. I'm able to stretch my thinking in great ways. And yes, we think in layers, but the layers are so much deeper now with the AI tools that we have. And if you think of us connecting dots or data points, there's only so much you can do in a given time frame of a project. And now we can really expand that to do so much more in the same amount of time that we were given. And I love that. So connecting those dots, getting deeper, it's enriching our solutions and making them, I think, more valuable. And I think it's getting us more mileage. And we're seeing that. I think we're just scratching the surface. If I'm being honest, we're experimenting. We're still in the final phase. I don't know if we even understand the full reach yet, but I know it's bringing a lot of excitement to our teams. And
right.
We're being playful. Yeah.
Intentionally playful, maybe, right?
Intentionally playful would be a great way to say that.
Yeah, I think for a while we've lived in a data-driven world, and the great hope of AI has kind of been that we could actually synthesize all that into something meaningful. And so I would just say that it's letting us come up to speed on the context of our clients and our projects more quickly. And it's letting us ask better questions to them about that. Like, how much do I actually know about nuclear medicine? Or how much do I actually know about what any of our clients do? I'm not as expert as that. It would be great to spend 3 months with them, just getting to know them, but right. They don't have that time. And like Tim said, our projects don't actually have that time either. And so it allows us to quickly gather context about the relevant situation or the relevant environment or geography or any number of things and synthesize this into something that can actually drive design in a way that you couldn't before. Like it's the equivalent of opening up an atlas over here and opening up over there and talking to like reading some research paper here. And to be able to do that within minutes is pretty wild at this point. Like Tim said, probably just scratching the surface that I'm still some sort of conduit for all of this. And soon that will be maybe more or less needed in a certain way, right. Or I'll be doing it differently. Like I won't be doing as much interpreting as I am. But right now that's where I see it enabling me.
It almost makes sense. If I could just add to that, it almost allows us to make sense of the chaos. We know all that information's out there, but it would take a computer to understand it. And AI is that tool that really can organize that data and that chaos and present it in a way that allows us to make something useful out of it to inform our designs. And I think that's, for me, the helpful part of it.
Now let's dig a little deeper. You both mentioned we're kind of scratching the surface. What's actually changing the way that you work on a practical level?
It's that real-time sites. It's not having to go and spend all the time researching, putting together, and kind of assimilating all the data. It's instantaneous. I can't tell you how many times we've spent hours in a conference room and trying to fill a whiteboard
right.
full of information so that we can step back and look at it together as a team. Well, now it's like turning on the lights. If you think about it, it's like the lights go on. I feel like I can cover the whiteboards and the display monitors in a conference room instantaneously with some of these tools that we have. It reminds me of the evolution that we went through with visualization in our industry.
Yeah.
20 years ago, we used to put a little note on our monitor that says, "Don't turn this computer off rendering." And it was a view that we wanted to see. And we'd go to lunch or we'd come back a few hours later to see what that view looked like. And that view was great, but it took a while to see. Like, and we would make a design decision based on that view. And maybe it was the wrong view. We had to change it, or the lighting wasn't right. We had to make adjustments. Well, of course, now we have real-time rendering engines that we can flip a switch and we can move all over and see the building in real time. That visualization is just one aspect that informs our design decisions. Now we're talking about data points and simulation, and it's just gotten so much more informative for us. It's a really exciting time to be a designer.
You make a really good point too, Tim, from the visualization that I got of you talking about drawing on a whiteboard, right? It's the speed and the depth. So you would take that whiteboard, let's say, and maybe the meeting's ending and you take a picture of it. Maybe you send it to everybody that was in the meeting. It's static, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you can keep prompting the AI with your spreadsheet or whatever it is that you're working on. It's going to go deeper and faster.
Oh, it's a warm
way more so than you can do on a whiteboard, of course. But
yeah. And when, that kind of text-based, I don't know what you call it, process is really interesting for me to see evolve. There's a long tradition, I think, of like text and how that relates to architecture. But with clients, we're often developing some sort of a vision or some sort of drive for them, right? And that might be what's on that whiteboard that we're talking about, or at least the formation of that. And it used to be a process that you needed someone with some experience to filter those words and come up with what might be the drivers of this particular process. You don't really need that person anymore, right? Like, you take the picture of the whiteboard and you run it through ChatGPT or something else, and it spits back to you the things you would have done, that I would have come up with, but also like six more that maybe I wouldn't have. And so it's interesting to find the ways that we can use that text-based version of AI to enhance our process. And it's not just in terms of drivers, it's in terms of sustainability strategies, program strategies. So many things can come through that.
I was reading a book on AI in our industry, and I hope I have this quote right, but it was, "We've been using computers to increase our efficiency and precision. Let us view the computer as our muse, as a partner in design, as a tool to expand our imagination." I think that's just that pivot, right? No longer using it as a tool to just make it more efficient and speed us up. And I think that's the fun part. It is a little muse. I love that. Our dance partner. So
right.
Design.
The one thing that we haven't touched on when we're talking about some of this maybe is a little bit of the VR side. Justin, do you have any thoughts on how VR has impacted some of the work that we do?
Yeah, in a lot of ways. I think internally, we see what we're doing very quickly. The feedback loop is fast, and it's not the computer, obviously, with the post-it that Tim mentioned. We're walking around our spaces. That allows us to think about human experience in a deeper way than we have previously. You know, there's also, beyond just walking through the building itself, there's products out there that allow us to create a virtual environment where we have all kinds of context information about the project. So you have the model on the table virtually, you have a specific room model, you have site information and all of that, and you and the client can get in there together across miles.
Wow.
And experience what might have needed to be set up like as a whole day setup exercise to have just an hour meeting. Like this can be something virtually updated that moves very quickly. And that's what we're trying to get to with our clients and with our teams.
Tim, I've heard not just you, but a lot of us, even in a leadership and director level, talking about how much we strive to be, and we are, an expertise-based firm. But I want to find out from you, what does the next decade look like? What does it mean to be an expertise-based firm over the next 10 years?
Interesting, because, you know, the foundation's shifting a little bit for us because we've prided ourselves on being an expertise-based firm at Healing, Learning, and Discovery. But as that foundation starts to shift, you know, clients are starting, just like a lot of people, to turn to AI, for example, and ask questions that they're going to start to get answers back that are very similar to what our experts would say or give them. And it's not just our industry, it's every industry, right? So where does that put us? We can't just be knowledgeable about building types. We have to be knowledgeable about the tools. We have to be experts at, in command of the new technology, the latest technology. We have to be able to provide design leadership. We have to be able to focus on areas that maybe AI struggles a little bit. And I think that's why you'll hear us say, you know, we want our teams to be curious. We want them to be problem solvers. AI is great at giving you ideas, but you have to prompt it the right way, right? It's not going to reach out and tell you the problem to solve. We have to be the ones still at the end of the day to make sure that we're solving the right problems. So for me, that's expertise. It just needs to be expanded. The definition of what it means to be an expert. It can't just be to be knowledgeable about the handful of projects typologies that you've done in the past. That's not an expert anymore.
I would say it's really about becoming a curator is maybe another way to frame that. I've always kind of seen my work that way, in that I'm a little bit of a generalist, but I'm able to identify the interesting parts of things and pull those together in some way. And that's really the skill of a curator, is some sort of taste maker or educated decision maker. And I think that's really what an expert is becoming, because if you've used any of these text-based tools, GPT-based tools, you find, like, you'll ask it something, gives you an amazing amount of information, and then you say something and it almost always says, oh, good question. And it's what I've always felt like is, well, that isn't that what you should have introduced that. And so I think actually in that gap is where the experts live, is like, sure, I've got all this junk from that, but which piece of junk is important in this moment? And there's still a lot, I think, that isn't, that I can't just come from AI there.
Right.
And that's the interesting part of it to me. That fills the gap. Yeah.
I noticed that myself. I'm not putting myself on your guys' level, of course, but, you know, Tim and I were recently having a conversation about making some website updates. And then I was meeting with our team a little bit. And we were meeting with our web developers. And like you said, it's a curation of like 20 some years of experience of running websites, and immediately going like, okay, I don't like that. I like this. This is functional. This is not. I could have AI make a website for us, right? But there are some intuitive things that you're just immediately able to spot with your eyes that are a little out of whack or that maybe need to be realigned differently. So very, very, very good point, Justin. I don't think we can have a conversation about design that inspires what's next and talking about design philosophy and design future if we don't talk about sustainability. So my question is, how is sustainability evolving in your work?
Yeah, for a while now, people have been moving beyond the checklist. Like, that's not a new idea. I think you see that in the transition or in terms of favor from lead to well. Like, well is kind of the hot thing or has been for a few years. And that's because it connects, I think, at a deeper level with the operation of the places that we make and the way our clients will operate them. Of course, we know that the embodied energy of the building, you know, has something to do with construction. But the operation of that building, especially if we're designing, you know, types of facilities we are, really the weight of it, the energy that goes into it, the carbon that goes into it is going to be in the operations of it. So we want to think about this as holistically and completely as possible. We also want these places to be sustainable in terms of the way they support our clients and the business model that's out there. So I think we're seeing like a closer companionship of operational models for any of our project types and the design that we make. Those are paired really closely. And then that allows you to come up with the strategies that might be appropriate for that client once you understand how those two things are working in parallel.
Pretty spot on. We want our buildings to not only look good, but we want them to perform beautifully as well. Those two things have to be in alignment, both operationally and the design vision. They go hand in hand. And moving away from point buying and checklists and all the accreditation, there's buying plaques for the wall.
But in terms of meaning, what is the next evolution that you guys see?
Very simply, sustainability can be about energy and materials. But the buildings that we preserve and that we keep are really the buildings and spaces that endure emotionally. You know, do people want to be there? Do they care for it? How does it stay relevant? Those are just as important of questions to ask. Sometimes, you know, here in St. Louis, you'll see certain buildings and you're like, why? Why is this one the one that's still here and that one not? And it's not necessarily related to the sum of its parts, right? There's an emotional, softer side of this that is just as important to think about when we think about our buildings.
It's no secret. When a space is meaningful, people protect it, right? They maintain it. They adapt it instead of abandoning it. The emotional connection, that sense of this place matters, is what makes a design truly sustainable over time. And I think that's the role of the designers to make sure that we deliver on that.
I've heard you and some of our other design principals also say we're about creating meaningful spaces. So what does creating meaningful spaces mean to both of you personally?
So it's really about a building that transcends that container for things that I was talking about earlier. You know, it exceeds its function, it uplifts, it heals, it sparks discovery. And it does that for reasons beyond just having, you know, the furniture in the right place or the counter here at a certain height. And I think that's where meaning comes in, when it starts to transcend the function and artfully showcases what our clients are doing and their mission and their vision.
For me, meaningful spaces shows up in the details. When I look around, especially on the completed project, it's how we artfully organized equipment, or we laid out a space, or it's in the way we detailed a certain piece of casework. It shows that we listened. You know, it shows that we developed a deep level of understanding of what the people we designed the space for needed, and it's going to work. And, you know, when we work on a project, it's a 1 to 3 year relationship that we develop with these people. But at the end of the day, we walk away from the space, and that person lives in our thoughts and our design thinking. And I think it's just great. And it's a meaningful space when you've left them in a space that's going to really work for them.
Along those lines, let's talk a little bit about design leadership. You've both said the role of a designer is evolving. What does it mean today to be a design leader, especially in a firm grounded in expertise?
Well, design leadership today is less about having all the answers and more about being a curator, as Justin kind of pointed out earlier, of the right ideas, tools, and strategies. Our best designers aren't just experts in building type. Design leadership today is less about having all the answers and more about being a curator of the right ideas, tools, and strategies. Justin kind of talked about being a curator earlier. Our best designers aren't just experts in building type. They're experts in how to think.
Yeah, I don't want to rehash curator too much here, but the other part of that is curating the feedback of our clients and thinking about who are we listening to and when, and how do we take all of their feedback seriously, but synthesize that into a meaningful space. Like maybe you've seen a painting created by a committee, or, you know, the art concept of an exquisite corpse, right? Where like everyone's drawing a little piece in part, and that can create like a really bad building, right? If you take everyone's feedback as equal volume, equal time. And so I think that as an expert, you kind of know what people are really saying without listening exactly to what they're saying. And you turn that into something that responds to all their needs in the right way at the right level. And that's what creates a really meaningful place.
Yeah, I think the other part of that is we love the idea of there's one designer. And we are, of course, as design principals, we're the designer of the project. But design solutions are really fed by so many people and so much thinking. So many talented individuals on the team contribute to it. And that design leadership really is the artful person who can come in and conduct those people and get the right solutions coming in at the right time, leveraging the right technology. It really has to come together the right way. And if you do it right, you end up with an inspired solution. If you do it wrong, you know, you end up with a solution that you wish you would have maybe put a little bit more time into. You never want to be in that position.
So let's wrap up with this. If we're having this conversation, which we won't be because we'll all be retired, but if we were going to have this conversation at BSA 75th, what would you hope we're celebrating?
For me, that it's that we didn't just survive the AI revolution, is that we thrived in it. And what do I mean by that? We're leading in the industry with the tools, the current tools, that we're providing the inspired solutions. Our teams are curious more than they are now. And I think that's the important thing. We kind of lean on AI now because it's helping us be curious. I would love for us to not be so dependent on the tool, but it's creating over time a generation of thinkers that don't really even need the tool because they're almost trained to think
and be curious
a little bit deeper. And they're almost naturally trained to kind of continue the thought. That's my hope anyway, is that we start to get a little bit less production oriented thinking,
right?
And that we become almost to the point where our teams are thinking in ways that generations before them weren't even thinking. I'm optimistic for the future. I think it's going to be a really exciting time for our industry.
To me, that meaning will become ever more important as we have, you know, as we just proliferate the amount of data that we're consuming each day. Like Tim said, that we're curious about things. And I think behind curiosity is a search for meaning in our work, a search for places that really add meaning to what we do. And so I think that would be a really good place to be, you know, that it hasn't been some sort of race to a post-apocalyptic bottom.
Right.
It's actually enabled a new level of flourishing, whether that's in the way BSA's business functions, but also the way we see our world around us. That there's really an abundance to what we might expect to come out of this revolution. And that would be really exciting.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining me. I enjoy talking to you both so much. Your thoughts on this and just design and the way we think and approach problem solving is spectacular. So thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for finally having us back.
Special thanks again to Tim and Justin for joining me on this episode of BSA by Design. You can connect with them on LinkedIn. If you want to learn more about BSA, we encourage you to visit our website at bsalifestructures.com. There's a link in the show notes to contact us for more information. Be sure to subscribe to BSA by Design on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music so you don't miss an episode. And we've got more content and project stories to share on social media, so be sure to follow us on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and X. That's going to do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.